apparently somebody found a zero day in the Linux kernel using strictly OpenAI's O3 model. This article here by Sean Heelan. Want to give it a read to see, you know, how it went, how they did it, and if AI is gonna take away our jobs. Also, we have Twitch chat here with us. Say hi, Twitch chat. Hi, Twitch chat. Hooray. Okay, cool. How I use O3 to find CVE-2025-37899, a remote zero-day vulnerability in the Linux kernel's SMB implementation. But before that, we got to talk about today's sponsor for the video. Me. I'm the sponsor. It's me. Hello. I honestly believe that if you're a programmer trying to write fast, effective code, or you're a cybersecurity professional trying to stop your stuff from getting attacked, all of these require you to know the basic fundamentals of computers. My courses on Low-Level Academy teach you languages like C, networking in C, threading in C, assembly, and even a new installment, Rust, to learn the basics of how computers work. And Zero to Hero C Programming will teach you the basics of the C programming language, the language that runs all other languages, and you can even learn arrays in C right now for free. Go check that lesson out. If you want to learn assembly, my ARM load operations lesson is also free. And I also have a free 3-day C course that you can check out right here on the landing page. Guys, if you want to be a good programmer, you got to know the fundamentals. And where do you learn the fundamentals? On Low Level Academy. All right, guys, back to the video. See you there. All right, in this post, I'll show you how I found a zero-day vulnerability in the Linux kernel using OpenAI's O3 model. I found the vulnerability using nothing more complicated than the O3 API, no scaffolding, no agentic frameworks, and no tool use. This is super interesting, man. There's a lot of work that's been going on with companies and with government in particular, trying to find ways to find bugs in software using just AI. The reason I said government, if you didn't know, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, they ran AICC. I don't know what CC stands for, but it was a competition at DEF CON about 2 years ago where they were trying to strictly just find vulnerabilities using AI in software. It's a crazy world that we live in where this is even possible. And apparently this guy did it. So recently I've been auditing KSMBD for vulnerabilities. KSMBD is a Linux kernel server which implements the SMB3 protocol and kernel space for sharing files over a network. Yep. I started this project specifically to take a break from LLM-related tool development, but after the release of O3, I couldn't resist using bugs that I had found in KSMBD as a quick benchmark of O3's capabilities. Okay. All right. So this is where... Okay, so he already had found the bugs, right? This is one thing that I don't, that is the problem with vulnerability research in general, right? That is the reason why CTF, capture the flag, and vuln research separately are different things. When you're hunting for bugs in a place that you know there will be a bug, that is much different than just doing general vulnerability research or security engineering, right? There's a problem with doing security engineering across the board is you have a finite amount of time you have to spend on what feels like an infinite amount of code, right? And so you have to decide quickly what things you do and don't spend time on. And if you know there's already a bug in a location because you've either found it previously or it's a capture the flag, like a separate scenario, that's much different than just like, hey, secure this product, because then you have to like do threat model analysis to figure out what actually matters. In the future post, I'll discuss O3's performance across all of those bugs, but here we'll focus on how O3 found a zero day during my benchmarking. Vulnerability it found is, yep, fixed here, a use after free in the handler for the SMB log off command. Very interesting. Understanding the vulnerability requires reasoning about concurrent connections to the server and how they may share various objects in specific circumstances. This is one of the hardest conditions to fuzz for. So if you guys don't know, when you're doing like vulnerability research or security engineering type work, what you're trying to do is find like memory corruption vulnerabilities, right? And one of the strategies you use to do this is called fuzzing. What happens is you inject arbitrary data and watch where down the graph the arbitrary data goes. This is called fuzzing. And ideally what you're doing is you're trying to find all the possible configurations of that graph. And maybe one of them has a bug where you like don't handle a specific input correctly, right? A use after free vulnerability is very difficult to find because a use after free vulnerability is dependent on state, right? The state of a system, whether an object is or is not freed, is hard to fuzz. Because typically fuzzing, you do a single run down a graph and that's it. Use after freeze require the state to be set up so that there was a thing that was in use, it is freed, and then it is used somewhere else. And getting the combination of those states correct is like very low probability. So these are very hard to find. So if you can find these with AI, that's a huge win. O3 is able to comprehend this and spot a location where a particular object was not reference counted, is freed while still being accessible by another thread. Interesting. Okay, I'm assuming they're using like smart pointers and C++ and stuff in this. Let's see here. Benchmarking O3 using the CVE. Let's first discuss CVE-2025-37778, a vulnerability that I found manually and which I was using as a benchmark for O3's capabilities when it found the zero day. Oh, okay. So he already had a bug elsewhere and he found a new bug with O3. Okay. That's much different than what I thought was happening, where he already found a bug and was just refinding the bug. Okay. So he knew a bug existed. He was trying to benchmark O3 using that bug and then he found a new bug. Okay. So this bug is a use after free vulnerability. The issue occurs during the Kerberos authentication path when handling a session setup request from a remote client. To save us referring to CVE numbers, I'll refer to this as the Kerberos authentication vulnerability. So the root cause is as follows. Let's look at here. So this is Kerberos 5 authenticate, some context object, some request object, some response object. If the session state is equal to SMB session valid, KSMBD free user, session user. Okay, so they free it, and then retval equals curb authenticate session in blob inlen. I'm assuming they don't check for the user to have been freed. There's no flag here. They're also not setting this pointer to null, so they could easily use this anywhere else. Okay, so if curb authenticate detects the session state is session valid, it then frees session user. The assumption here appears to be that afterwards, either SMBD authenticate will reinitialize or it will be a valid new value, or that after returning from curb authenticate, with a return value of e negative inval, that sesh user will not be used anywhere else. As it turns out, this assumption is false. We can force the authenticate function to not reinitialize session user, and we can access session user even if it returns negative e inval. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, this is a classic use after free, man. It's like the problem with this stuff is you have different functions that have different contracts, and when you make assumptions about how those contracts interact, you get these weird statefulness issues where, like, the assumption here was that if this had been freed, this will handle it. But on certain edge cases in that function, it doesn't handle it, right? So because of that, you can use this value after it's been freed. This vulnerability is a nice breakdown for LLM capabilities, as it is interesting by virtue of being part of the remote attack surface of Linux kernel. Yeah, I mean, finding a zero day in the remote attack surface of the Linux kernel is a big deal. It is not trivial, as it requires figuring out how to get session state equal to SMB session valid in order to trigger the free, right? Because you have to hit this branch to figure out how to actually free the thing. Realizing that there are paths in that function that do not reinitialize session user and reasoning about how to trigger those paths. Okay, interesting. And then realizing that there are other parts of the code base you can potentially access session user. Yeah, I mean, so basically what he's describing is, like, you as a human, I have to know all three of these things, right? Again, this is why use after frees are so hard to detect, because there are combinations of state that you have to know that are possible, and then when combined cause the UAF, you know, state, right? And so in theory, AI that is able to have a larger mental context of the code base at once, like when, as I'm doing code analysis, right, as I'm doing static analysis, I can have, like, at most two or three function states, like, in my head as I'm reading it. But as it grows past that, you start to, like, it gets fuzzy as to, like, how the functions interact, where the AI can read the entire code base at one time. So if you can describe this to an LLM, and maybe it can do better analysis at that level. Well, this is not trivial. It is also not insanely complicated. I could walk a colleague through the entire code path in 10 minutes. Well, yeah, you could walk a colleague through this code path, but finding this code path is the complicated part, right? And you don't really need to understand a lot of auxiliary information about the Linux kernel, the SMB protocol, or remainder of KSMBD outside of connection handling and session setup code. Yeah, I calculated how much code you would need to read at a minimum if you read every KSMBD function along the path from packet arriving to the KSMBD module, the vulnerability being triggered, and it worked out about 3.3K lines of code. Yeah, no, sure. Like, the path to follow to get this vulnerability to exist is very small, but to find the vulnerability would require you to read the majority of the code, which is different. Okay, so we have the vulnerability we want to use for evaluation. Now, what code do we show the LLM to see if it can find it? My goal here is to evaluate how O3 would perform were it the backend for a hypothetical vulnerability detection system. So we need to ensure we have clarity on how much a system would generate queries to the LLM. In other words, it is no good arbitrarily selecting functions to give to the LLM to look at if we can't clearly describe how an automated system would select those functions. The ideal use of an LLM is we give it all the code from a repository, it ingests it, and spits out the result. However, due to context window limitations and regressions in performance that occur as the amount of context increases, this isn't particularly possible right now, or practically impossible right now. Yeah, that is one issue with LLMs, right? You've probably seen plenty of videos about this. As the context window of a LLM gets bigger. Basically, as the conversation you have with it gets longer, its ability to reason on that conversation gets worse, right? And this makes sense because like you're basically increasing the amount of data it has to go through, and the amount of time it's going to spend on computing, the context of that window decreases, right? So the ability for it to reason also decreases. And so what they're saying here is like, okay, we basically just need to figure out how do we figure out what functions, what code to give to the AI so that we're not giving it the entire code base, right? If you give it the entire code base, that would suck, A, for both us and the LLM, but also B, like you're giving it leaf functions that don't matter. You're giving it like random utility functions that like the user can't even access. What I would suggest, or what I would, I'm assuming they're going to do, is they're going to probably give it all of the code from the source of user input down to the bottom of some graph, right? But not the rest of maybe the utility code in the server. So maybe they want to attack like one particular use case, like user is able to log in. What can they do from that position on the network, right? Let's see here. So instead, I thought one possible way that an automated tool could generate context for the LLM was through the expansion of each SMB command handler individually. So I gave the LLM the code for the session setup command handler, including all the code for all functions it calls and so on, up to a call depth of 3, this being the depth required to include all of the code necessary to reason about the vulnerability. Okay, so he's basically saying in the previous bug, you know, that he found, you only had to go 3 calls deep after session establishment. So if I can just give the LLM all that code, can it figure out the bug? Okay, so to limit the amount of context that the LLM has, right, they're basically just saying like, let's give it only the code from network receive up to, you know, handle the function, right? And when you're doing black box like vulnerability research, right, like you're looking at maybe firmware, for example, this is a technique that I use, right? Literally, I don't care about the totality of the firmware. I don't care about all of the code. I care about where does the user have control, which is the receive function, right? Or like the packet ingest function. And then what part of the call graph can they get down to? And then I'll go through and I'll look individually through each command they can hit, right? The echo response command, the login command, the list device status command, right? All that stuff. And those are going to likely be the places that I care about the most because those are the places that the user can control, right? I don't care about the socket setup, right? I don't care about the TCP socket setup. None of that crap matters. And from an LLM perspective, if you added that to the context, you would be requiring the LLM to process that data while it having literally zero significance for the sake of the research. I also include all the code for the functions that read data off the wire, parses incoming requests, selects the command handler to run, and then tears down the connection after the handler is completed. Without this, the LLM would have to guess at how various data structures were set up, and that would lead to more false positives. Now, that makes sense. And this is one of the issues that I've had trying to do LLM research or vulnerability research with LLMs. It will freak out at the smallest thing and create a ton of false positives, which a real bug may be hiding in, but if you don't have time to evaluate all the false positives, it kind of defeats the purpose, right? In the end, this comes out to roughly 3,300 line of code, 27,000 tokens. Give us a benchmark we can use to contrast O3 with prior models. If you're interested, the code to be analyzed is here as a single file created with files to prompt tool. Ooh, I'm actually curious. Concatenate a directory full of files into a single prompt for use with LLMs. Oh, interesting. Okay, simple tool, but I mean, I like it. And so what is the actual end state here? Documents. Oh, okay, it's tagging it in like XML so that it could tell the LLM to like handle this. Like this is your attack surface, right? Very interesting stuff. Okay, cool. The final decision is what prompt to use. You can find the system prompt and other information I provided in this Git repo. Yeah, what is the system prompt here? Can this be explainer prompt, audit request prompt? I'm curious. Audit the code for security vulnerabilities. Remember to check all of your reasoning. Avoid reporting false positives. It's better to say that you cannot find any vulnerabilities and to report a false positive. Okay, very simple prompt, actually. Very not complex prompt. I'm kind of shocked, actually, at how little is going on here. But I mean, I'm assuming they did find a bug, right? So I'm assuming it worked. I told the LLM to look for user-free vulnerabilities. I gave it a brief, high-level overview of what KSMBD is, its architecture, what the threat model is. Oh, okay, so let's look at the actual KSMBD prompt then. This code is for the Linux kernel's SMB server implementation. There are two components. There's a kernel component, which accepts SMB connections and processes them. Again, why this is happening in the kernel, I could not tell you. I still don't understand for the life of me why this happens. A user space component, KSMBD tools, which is used to handle RPC calls, certain parts of authentication process, and other functionality. The kernel component uses the netlink IPC call to call the user space component. Yeah, okay. Attackers can connect to the kernel component using TCP, KSMBD spawns new kernel threads to handle connections and concurrent processing as possible. I have provided you with the kernel source code for connection handling, reprocessing, and the handling of SMB setup requests. Okay, so this is a pretty standard prompt, right? Yeah, they go over the threat model and all that stuff. Okay. I tried to strongly guide it to not report false positives. I saw this and to favor not reporting bugs over reporting false positives. I have no idea if this helps, but I'd like it to help. So here we are. In fact, my entire system prompt is speculative in that I haven't ran a sufficient number of evaluations to determine if it helps or hinders. So consider it equivalent to me saying a prayer rather than anything resembling science or engineering. I mean, yeah, that's okay. I would rather just say it to see what happens. Vibe prompting classic. Yeah, this guy's out here vibe prompting his LLM. I'm all about it, dude. I'm the same way. Like when I do anything LLM related, it feels like it's going to scream, oh, you didn't initialize this variable on line 4,000. Like, okay, fine. But like, does that lead to an issue? So if you can tell it to not report things that aren't problems, that's better. So my experiment harness executes this 100 times, n equals 100, and saves the results. It's worth noting, if you rerun this, you may not get identical results to me as between running the original experiment and writing the blog post. I have removed the file containing the code to be analyzed. I had to regenerate it. I believe it is effectively identical, but okay, so basically there's a change. That's fine. O3 finds the Kerberos authentication vulnerability in the benchmark in 8 out of the 100 runs. Really? That's crazy. That is so low, man. Why? And this is what I really don't understand about LLMs, right? This is where my knowledge of LLMs kind of falls down. I don't understand why it finds it in some but not in others, right? You would think the process generally is the same. I mean, I don't know anything about like the nature of LLMs aside from like it's a graph where like the words have vectors that like denote different properties of the word, and like that's all I got. In another 66 of the runs, okay, so now we're at 74. O3 concludes so 66% of the runs there is no bug present, false negatives, and in the remaining 28 of the reports there are false positives. For comparison, Claude finds it in 3 out of the 100 runs. And 3.5 does not find it in 100 runs. It's just math, because LM is a statistic, stochastic, word generator. It's all stats down to the bottom. So if it's statistical probability, if the input is the same every time, why does it change? Like where does the mutation come from is what I want to know. They have some random parameters to prevent identical results and keeps from getting stuck in generation loops. Oh, okay. Okay. So it's like it's intentionally seeded so that the data, it doesn't give you the same output every time, right? To prevent like some kind of bias. Interesting. Sampling? Okay. Okay, interesting. This is extremely low. So on this benchmark, we have at least a 2x, 3x improvement in O3 over Claude, Sonnet 3.7. I'm curious how 4.0 performs. But yeah, this is really low, guys. Here's the problem. Again, going back to the point that I made before about like knowing that a bug already exists, right? There are 28 reports with false positives and 8 reports with an actual bug. So that means he had to wade 8 out of 36, right? So what is that? So a 25% positive over false positive rate. So a 75% miss rate. On hits. That's crazy. That's so bad. Though the rate is low, LM could do batching. Okay. That's the thing I don't know. So you could run multiple, you could do like, hey, run this 1,000 times. I'm sure you'd pay out the ass for that. But like you would, but again, so what that would mean is you would get out of 1,000, you would get 360, yes, there are bugs, reports, and of them, only 80 would be correct. How do you wade through that? And then how do you test those? I guess I'm curious what the false positives look like. O3 gets something that feels like a human written bug report condensed to just present the findings, whereas Sonnet 3.7, you get something like a stream of thought or a work log. There are pros and cons to both. O3's output is typically easier to follow due to its structure and focus. On the other hand, sometimes it is too brief and clarity suffers. Okay, interesting. So this is where it all comes together, right? So previously, if you lost track here, they were just figuring out like how likely is it that based on a bug we already know, can O3 find a new bug? Now, O3 finds a 0-day. Having confirmed that O3 can find the Kerberos authentication vulnerability, when given the code for the session setup command handler, I wanted to see if it could find it if I give it the code for all of the command handlers. This is a harder problem as the command handlers are all found in SMBD to packet data unit, packet data unit, which has roughly 9,000 lines of code. So we're doing a 3x the number of tokens. However, if O3 can still find vulnerabilities when given all the handlers in one go, then it suggests we can build a more straightforward wrapper for O3 that simply hands it entire files covering a variety of functionality rather than going handler by handler. I don't mind the handler by handler approach. I feel like that's a pretty, it's a rational way to do it because it allows you to kind of down select what things you are and aren't looking at based on the attack surface. And also when you get false positive reports, if it's just in one area of a command handler, like you can do a quick analysis to figure out if the report's actually sane. Or if you give it the entire file, I feel like it's a lot harder to to find truth in. But that being said, though, you're also trying to find use after freeze, and the more access to state you have across multiple handlers, that will increase the ability for a use after free to be found, right? Combining all the code for all the handlers with the connection setup and teardown code, as well as the command handler dispatch routines, ends up at about 12,000 lines of code, 100,000 input tokens. And as before, I have ran the experiment 100 times. O3 finds the Kerberos auth bug 1 out of 100 times with this larger number of input tokens. That's so bad, dude. That's so crazy. A clear drop in performance, that's a 66% like cutoff. It does still find it good. More interestingly, however, in the output from the other runs, I have found a report for a similar but novel vulnerability that I did not previously know about. The vulnerability is also due to a free session user, but this time in the session logoff handler. So when we do SMB2 session logoff, session user, oh, wait, no, hold on. So it can't be this because they set it to null. Session logoff, context, connection is a connection, session is a session. Close all the file descriptors, wait until it's idle, lock the thing, set the session to be expired, unlock the thing, free the user, set it to null. Okay, so maybe there's an internal, I don't know, interesting. So while 1K, oh, this is a race condition. Yeah, it's a use after free race condition. While one K SMBD worker thread is still executing requests that use session user, another thread that processes an SMBD logoff for the same session frees that structure. No synchronization protects the pointer, so the first thread to reference is free memory. A classic use after free. Yes, yeah, so there's a time of check, time of use bug right here. That's super tight though, man. That's hard to exploit. So there is this primitive in race conditions called time of check, time of use, right? So what you'll see here is that they do check that session user has a value, it is not null before they free it, right? You can't free a null pointer. And then after they free it, they set it to null. Good job. That's awesome. Like, that's what you should be doing for pointers. The problem here is that this is a multi-threaded platform, right? It is a kernel service that spawns kernel threads, right? So two threads may be working on the same session. And so there is a time of check, time of use bug where in between them checking this thing being set to a value, another thread may have freed it due to a separate logoff command, and then they use it somewhere else, right? There's no locking mechanism here that locks it to say that you can't touch it. There's no locking mechanism so that only one person can update it at a time, right? So because of this, like, this piece of code, while it is the correct way to free a session, is vulnerable to a race condition, causing a use after free. So just let me make sure that I'm actually not speaking out my ass, because I looked at this for 5 minutes. Maybe I misinterpreted it. No synchronization protects the pointer, so the first thread references free memory, a classic use after free that leads to kernel memory corruption and arbitrary code execution in the kernel context. Affected code path. So yeah, a second transport is bound to an existing connection. Worker A running a connection C2 receives a normal request. Check user session stores a pointer to the already existing session worker sesh and increments session ref count. The pointer to sesh is kept, but before worker A finishes, worker B running on the first connection processes an SMB2 logoff for the same session, executes the logoff, which frees it and they clear the field. But yeah, in between these two areas is where you could do the bug. That'd be extremely fast. Not exactly fast. You would have to basically, like, if you're the attacker, you'd have to know the latency of your two connections and know what proper setting of waiting hits that window, right? It's an extremely tight window of time. You basically have to make the attacker thread execute in between these two instructions, right? It's extremely tight, extremely tight. But that being said, like, SMBD free user is not just a free command. It probably has other functionality that frees substructures and stuff. So if you can make your command run while this is running, for example, some line in this function, that's where things can get pretty weird. Yeah, so then worker B does not wait for other connections that are still on the using the session. It only waits for the running request on its own connection. Worker A continues to execute inside of this and dereferences session user, which is now freed, right? Is there a way to know how likely it could happen? Well, what do you mean how likely it could happen? Like, the fact that this code pattern is in the code means that there is a vulnerability that could be exploited, right? Now, the threat, right, the evaluation of, like, how big the risk is a function of how easy it is to do this, right? So this is how CVEs get graded, right? If this were, like, a user says the word abracadabra and they get a buffer overflow, right, that is much different than this. So the CVE rating for this is probably much lower. I'm actually curious what the CVE rating is. Let me guess. It's going to be fairly high because it's remote and it gives the attacker the ability to get code execution in the kernel. However, it's very hard to exploit. So I'm going to give it probably like an 8.4. Is it not graded yet? Really? Oh, it was found 6 days ago. Is there really not a score for this right now? Really? Might be a funding issue. I'm really curious if the MITRE contract issue caused this, because this should have a score by now. Interesting. NIST, yeah, I know. Shake my head, NIST. What are y'all doing over there? Interesting. Okay, back to this. Okay, so we get the bug. Reading this report, thought my expectations shift in how helpful AI tools are going to be in vulnerability research. So this is, I guess, so my thing is like, okay, they had AI read the code against this prompt 100 times, right? Did this guy have to go through and now read 100 reports? I don't know. I'm not sure. So I guess it is a part of this article that I'm missing. I want to know, like, how did he go through how did he go through 100 reports and figure out this one was legit? That's my thing. Because if I was given 100 reports that looked like this, if it was just one report, I would say, okay, that report's probably legit. It's one report. But if I'm given 100 reports like this and I know some of them are fake, I now have to go through and like test all of them. And how did he do that? That's what I'm curious about. Reading this report, I felt my expectations shift on how helpful AI tools are going to be in vulnerability research. If we were to never progress beyond what O3 can do right now, it would still make sense for everyone working in VR to figure out what parts of their workflow could benefit from it and to build the tooling to wire it in. No, I totally agree, man. Like, it literally, AI is a program that can read code and do analysis on it. Now, the accuracy of that analysis is variable, but like he said, it did find a vulnerability. So my thing is now, how did he take the noise and reduce the noise and increase the signal ratio, right? Like, how did he increase the SNR? That I need to know. Of course, part of that wiring with figuring out how to deal with the signal of noise ratio literally read my mind of one to 50 in this case. Yeah. And that's something we're already making progress at. Okay. One other interesting point of note is when I found the Kerberos authentication vulnerability, the fix I proposed was this. Yeah, okay, exactly, right? So in the first bug, right, the one that he used to benchmark this, if they had done the session user equals null thing, this would have fixed the bug. However, this is the same pattern that gave them the time of check, time of use bug in the new vulnerability he found. There's no locking mechanism on this, right? So the race condition still exists. When I read the bug report above, I realized this was insufficient. Yes, the logoff handler already sets session user equal to null, but it's vulnerable. It's still vulnerable as it allows two connections to bind to the same session. And there's nothing on the authentication path to prevent another thread making use of the session user in the short window after it has been freed before it set to null. Exactly. There's no locking mechanism on this. You'd use a mutex or something to make sure that no one else can touch this. And because of that, this fix that he proposed has the same bug as the vulnerability that O3 found, which is kind of crazy, kind of neat. I'd already made use of this property to hit a prior vulnerability in KSMBD, but I didn't think of it when considering the Kerberos authentication vulnerability. Having realized this, I went again through O3's results from searching for the Kerberos authentication vulnerability and noticed that in some of its reports, it had made the same error as me, in others it had not, and it had realized that setting session user equal to null was insufficient to fix the issue to the possibilities offered by session binding. That is quite cool, as it means that I had used O3 to find and fix the original vulnerability I would have, in theory, done a better job than without it. That's true. That is a very good point. I say in theory, because right now the false positive to true positive ratio is probably too high. But definitely say I would have gone through each report from O3 with diligence required to spot its solution. Still, that ratio is only going to get better. Conclusion, LLMs exist at this point in the capability space of program analysis techniques that is far closer to humans than anything else we have seen. Considering the attributes of creativity, flexibility, and generality, LLMs are far more similar to a human code auditor than they are to symbolic execution, abstract interpretation, or fuzzing. Yeah, so like what he's saying here basically is like people think an LLM is a computer, right? An LLM is just a CPU that runs a program, so we can treat LLMs as if it were a symbolic execution engine, right? Symbolic execution is basically you take the graph of a program running and you convert it to a math problem that you use an SMT solver to solve for certain parts of the graph, right? Now, that is not the case, and what he's saying here is that because of how LLMs are designed, they are much closer to, instead of it treating it like a computer program, you're literally giving another human the code to read, and it can read it faster than you, is effectively what he's saying. Now, since GPT-4, there have been hints at the potential of LLMs in vulnerability research, but the results on real problems have never quite lived up to the hope or to the hype. That has changed with O3, and we have a model that can do well enough at code reasoning, Q&A, programming, and problem solving that it can genuinely enhance performance at vulnerability research. O3 is not infallible, far from it. There's a substantial chance it will generate nonsensical results and frustrate you. What is different is that for the first time, the chance of getting correct results is sufficiently high that it is worth your time and your effort to try to use on real problems. Great article, great read. Please go show Sean some love. I love this tie-up. I love the way that he wrapped this up. I completely agree, right? So that is the one thing I wish he had gone a little deeper on is how did he sort through the signal-to-noise ratio, right? Because he was given 100 bug reports. Of them, two were correct, right? One of them being a previous bug that he found and one being a new bug. And actually, through finding the new bug, he realized his old fix was insufficient. I like his analysis, too. I agree. The fact that he's like, hey, AI used to not be good at this. Now we can actually use AI to do manual vulnerability research, and it's going to get better. So there is a world where AI, as it improves, can find bugs in software fairly automatically. The hard part is going to be like, how do you sift through the SNR? And then as, I forget his name, but the lead maintainer of Curl is experiencing, too, there's a lot of AI-generated bug reports that are just not correct. That is basically clogging up the machine of people trying to maintain their code. So I don't know. Either way, great article, guys. If you like this kind of stuff, do me a favor, hit that sub button. I appreciate it. I'm a vulnerability researcher in my day job. I'm a security engineer in my day job. This is what I do. I love this stuff. I talk about this stuff as often as possible here on YouTube, but also on Twitch. So go check that out, and we'll see you in the next one. Take care, guys. Goodbye.